Ingham County voters will elect a new county prosecutor tomorrow, and I'll remind everyone, especially if your mind is not made up, if you'd like to learn a little bit more about the candidates, all six of them appeared on... We won't elect a new prosecutor tomorrow. I take that back. It's a primary. We'll decide the two finalists is what we will do. I'm way ahead of myself here. I'm only 3 months ahead of myself. Come on. But we did speak with all six primary candidates here on Current State, and you can hear all of those interviews. If you feel that would help, I'd like to think they would. Current State, everything that we do on Current State ends up at WKAR.org. Click on radio, then click on Current State, and you are off to the races. Two Republicans, four Democrats in tomorrow's primary for to become the next Ingham County prosecutor. Glad you could join us here today. We've got a new month. We've got another issue to decide tomorrow. Ingham County voters will decide whether to create a tax millage to pay for a new $9.6 million animal shelter. Our first guest supports the proposal. Penelope Cernglue is about to wrap up 4 years serving on the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. The East Lansing Democrat is an attorney and the owner of the Lansing Business Practical Political Consulting. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Again, if approved, this would raise $9.6 million over 6 years, and it would replace the existing 45-year-old shelter in Mason. How much more would a homeowner pay for this if it passed?
The average Ingham County homeowner with a home valued $150,000, tax at $75,000, would pay only $1.50 per month to pass this millage.
And at 45, the existing facility is admittedly old. Beyond the age of the building itself, what's wrong with the facility?
Sure. So the facility has lots of problems with it currently. It just doesn't meet modern standards for sanitation, for animal welfare, for efficiency. The airflow system is bad. The storage areas are non-existent. We've had to convert areas that weren't intended for storage into storage areas. Mm. We've also had to convert storage areas into animal care areas. The dog kennels, the cat housing areas are just substandards. They don't meet modern standards. And there are no quiet areas in the facility. Noise and odors go all over the facility right now. So there's a lot of stress for the animals, for the staff, for visitors. It's not good to have adopters come there or people searching for their lost animals. The facility is set up kind of like a maze right now so that it's hard to find anything. We have outgoing animals and incoming animals all coming through the same door, the same lobby, the same areas. So we don't have any separation there. And it's just simply not big enough to meet the increasing needs that we have in our county. 45 years ago, animal control was just a very different thing, and our population has increased substantially.
The animal population is what you're saying.
Animal and human population.
Well, true
so
enough.
Both.
Has the animal population increased dramatically over 45 years?
So it certainly has, but we're actually reaching kind of a point right now where as we're promoting new programs and spaying and neutering and doing trap, neuter, release programs, we're hoping to see a stabilization of the pet population because people are doing those things now. They're seeing that these things work and they want those programs in their community. And that's a big thing that the animal control does as well.
Did the county look at an upgrade?
We absolutely did. We had internal assessments. We had the National Animal Control Association do an assessment, as well as Hobbs & Black Associates, which is a firm in Lansing. We explored upgrading the current facility. We explored the Road Commission building, which is also located in Mason. And everything we found showed that the most cost-effective thing to do would be to start over and build a new facility.
Penelope Cernglue is a Democratic member of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. We're talking about why she supports a new millage to build a new $9.6 million animal shelter. Now, the Greater Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce has expressed doubts about the millage. I spoke with Steve Japping, a of the chamber on Friday. He says they're not against animals by any means, but and they don't have an official a position on this, apparently. But he does say he called it, a questionable priority given other issues. I mean, he cited poor roads and infrastructure and legacy costs, senior care, and a few others. I don't think that's an uncommon question or argument. How do you respond to people who say, hey, we've got bigger fish to fry here. We got other issues that we should be dealing with, like a jail, for example.
Sure. So that's exactly why this millage makes sense. By putting a millage out there and allowing for millage funds to cover the new shelter and increase services to the public, we are not affecting our current county budget. So we can continue to prioritize other things in our county budget that are important. Certainly, you know, all of those things cited are important concerns. And this allows us to go to the people, the voters, and say, do you think it's important to have a new sanitary, humane, and efficient animal shelter and increase services for the county? It's a really unique opportunity for us to improve a service that we currently have and ensure that it will continue, but at the will of the people. We say, is this important to you? You get to vote. You get to tell us if this is important to you and you want to chip in $1.50 a month to pay for this service.
What are you hearing from your constituents here? Do you expect this will pass?
I do. We have received a lot of positive feedback. Particularly, I've received good feedback from my constituents in East Lansing. So I think it will certainly pass in East Lansing.
You're confident.
As far as I do think, you know, it, depending on how things go, though, it may be close. So we need everyone to vote. If everyone who we expect to vote votes, I do think that this will pass.
Mr. Japinga also suggested that Ingham could use an arrangement more like Clinton and Eaton counties. Apparently, they have collaborative working relationships with the Capital Area Humane Society that reduces the needs of those county governments. And he went on to cite tension here between Ingham and the Humane Society. Let's listen to that. Here's how he put it.
For whatever reason, the Capital Area Humane Society and Ingham County Animal Shelter are just they're not talking, they're not seeing eye to eye. And, you know, the chamber here, we're all about not duplicating efforts, you know, efficiency, making sure that the tax dollars are spent well and that there's results. And, you know, it's just unfortunate now that there'll be a millage question about building a brand new facility when the Capital Area Humane Society just got done with their capital fundraising effort on expanding their facilities out there that they've been doing a fantastic job.
So could the animal shelter's needs be lessened with a more collaborative relationship with the Humane Society?
Certainly. Any increased collaboration would be helpful. But we do collaborate. We absolutely do collaborate with the Capital Area Humane Society, with Voiceless Michigan, numerous other rescue groups and private organizations. With as many animals as we do have here, any collaborations are most welcome to us. We collaborate on spay-neuter programs, trap-neuter release. We transfer animals to the Capital Area Humane Society. The Capital Area Humane Society does currently have a very long waiting list, as many people that have attempted to transfer or surrender animals there would know. So sometimes they can take our animals, sometimes they can't.
His point seemed to be, though, that Eaton and Clinton counties have just a more robust connection to the Humane Society, to the point where maybe part of the reason we need the new facility is because those relationships are not developed as much as they could be. I think that was his point.
Yes,
does he have a point there?
That's simply not true. Eaton County and Clinton County, do have their own relationship. I imagine it's contractual. They're very small counties compared to Ingham County. The facilities that they've had in the past were very small, and they didn't see a lot of animals coming through their doors. Our numbers are exponential compared to these two counties and the animals that they take care of. We're also required by law to hold all stray animals for 7 to 10 days, regardless of who eventually adopts those animals out. We have to hold bite cases. We have to hold animal cruelty cases, dog fighting cases. There are a lot of animals
they
in Ingham County.
Eaton and Clinton don't have to do that, or?
They do, but they just don't have as much of it as we do.
Oh, okay.
Their operations just aren't as large as what we're seeing.
Well, Ingham's got to have the biggest population of those three counties.
Absolutely. And particularly in the city of Lansing, we have a lot of animals coming from the city.
I'm under the impression, though, you referred to adoption, that Ingham County wants to continue adoption services, and Eaton and Clinton have a different kind of do they farm that responsibility out to the Humane Society?
From what I've heard, that is what they do. And that, for us, would not be beneficial for our operation. Our low-cost adoptions, we feel that they provide a service to the community. They offset the housing costs of the animals that we have to house there while we hold them for their stray holds. They bring in community support. We have over 150 volunteers that currently volunteer at the shelter and assist with those programs. The adoptions, those are the good part of what animal control does. If we take that away, we just become the dog catcher. Mm. And we still have a tax burden. We still have to fund that because we're legally required to do that. So the adoptions, those are the good part. And that's something that, you know, that we want to keep as part of our operation. But with that being said, we do transfer animals to the Humane Society. Whenever they're willing to take them, we absolutely are willing to transfer them to the Humane Society or any other rescue group that is, you know, properly set up and legitimate and willing to take our excess animals.
Mr. Japping seemed to allude to some kind of tension between the Ingham Animal Control and the Humane Society. Is there anything, do you know anything about that?
Well, I know that our director has been part of collaborative coalitions with the Humane Society, and he has been working on increasing collaboration. So there's certainly been communication there.
Don't know anything about any tension, though.
There may have been several directors back in the past from what what some people had said about it, but currently, there's no reason, that there would be or should be, unless there's any type of, since they're both animal welfare organizations, some people are like, well, I support this one, I support that one. So there may be that for some people, but I think the Humane Society is a great organization. They provide a great service to our community. It's just a different service as a private organization versus the service that we provide as a public organization. For example, we're open admission. We have to take all animals that come to us, sick, injured, lost, stray, big, small, adoptable, not adoptable. We're required to take them. Mm. We can't turn them away if we're full. So we have to make appropriate accommodations.
Penelope Cernglue, again, a Democratic member of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. We're talking about her support for a new millage to build a $9.6 million animal shelter. The shelter would open up on Sundays if this passed, I take it.
Yes.
And it would hire more staff. Apparently being open 6 days a week has worked for many years. Why is opening on Sunday necessary?
So Sunday is a day, like Saturday, that many people don't have work. So they would find the shelter more easily accessible on Sundays than they may during the week. Saturdays, we have a huge amount of people come in because it's the only weekend day that the shelter is open. And it often creates lines and backups so that people are waiting more than an hour or two to be served. And we feel that on Sundays, if it's also open on Sundays, we can lessen those wait times for people and also just provide service in general. If you, lost your animal on Sunday, you can come in on Sunday and look for your animal. If you want to adopt on Sunday, you can do that. If you need to go give up your animal for whatever reason, you can do that on Sunday. You don't have to wait because we're closed on Mondays as well. You don't have to wait until Tuesday.
In the time that we have left, I know you're planning your departure from the Board of Commissioners after 4 years of service here. What are your thoughts on a new jail for Ingham County? Some would say that we need a millage for a new jail more than we need a millage for an animal shelter. It gets talked about a lot. What are your thoughts?
Well, we definitely need either a new jail or to update our current facility so that it meets guidelines for what we're required to provide.
Have you studied it close enough to have an opinion? I mean, could we upgrade the current jail, or do we need a new jail?
We actually are taking a second look at whether or not we could upgrade the current jail, because building a new jail is going to be very, very expensive, even compared to the new animal control facility. And we want to do, what is most cost effective for our community. So we're taking another look at whether or not it can be upgraded. And I can't say how that's going to turn out for sure. So
you're choosing not to run for re-election because your family's growing. Congratulations. And you want to spend more time with them. What have you learned in briefly? What have you learned in 4 years on the board? What are you going to take away from this experience?
Sure. Well, so I think it's been 6 years because I remember being elected in 2010.
Beg your pardon.
No problem. I just learned a lot about how the county government operates and all of the different departments and services that the county provides that most people just aren't aware of, and how they affect your everyday life. And I think the county does a lot with a little. And it's great to be knowledgeable of that, and I hope to continue to be involved as much as I can.
Penelope Cernglue is a Democratic member of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners for a few more months here. We're talking about why she supports a new millage to build a new $9.6 million animal shelter. Good luck to you. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
AARP is the voice of millions of older Americans. Their new president is Eric Schneiderwind of Lansing. Current state Scott Pohl talks with Schneiderwind about the issues being confronted by AARP. That's coming up on Current State. Lansing's Renegade Theater Festival will be back for its 11th year this month. It'll offer comedy, drama, musicals, live music, children's theater, readings of new works by local playwrights, and improv, all in Old Town Lansing. The dates are Thursday the 11th through the 13th, and then the following Thursday through Saturday. Local and area theater companies make the Renegade Festival happen. We welcome back to Current State one of its key organizers, Melissa Kaplan. Nice to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is a group thing. I mean, this is a bunch of local or area companies all on the same page, hitting the stage. Which companies are involved here?
There are theater companies and there are independent presenters. The theater companies include professional, collegiate, and community theaters. There's Williamston Theater, which is professional theater.
Yeah.
Community theaters, Peppermint Creek, Riverwalk Theater Company, Blue Light Players, Mid-Michigan Family Theater, and a brand new community theater, Generations Community Theater.
I don't know much about them.
And neither do I, but they heard about Renegade Theater Festival, and here they are. We're going to get to see them. They're doing a play called, let me look it up. I have my cheat sheet here because there is substantial amount of production going on. They're doing Bad Auditions by Bad Actors, which is a comedy, as you can imagine.
Full of potential.
Absolutely. There are the educational Michigan State University, well, the collegiate programs, Michigan State University and Lansing Community College. And then there are a number of independent producers who may have theater companies that they've created, but they are they're doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Aralia Garza with Sandcastle Productions, Rich Helder, Sandra Seaton with East End Productions. Those are all brand new. The Capital Area Players, which is a local theater company that focuses on African-American plays.
Sounds like this whole scene is growing. Sounds like the whole landscape is expanding.
I think it is. I feel that for our for a community our size, we have an incredible amount of theater going on here. We also have youth theater workshops and kids activities and games. It's a really performance-oriented community.
And the performances themselves are all confined to Old Town, or do they get outside of Old Town?
They are all in Old Town. We've expanded to 2 weekends, and we considered expanding beyond. The past few years, we felt that we've been just right at capacity because Old Town is, it has an incredibly high occupancy rate, and we perform in spaces as businesses allow us to. And so that varies from year to year as to what's available. Sometimes we're in some vacant storefronts, but this year, every single performance space is an active business that we're going to be in. And so every single year we look at how many, you know, who's coming to us, who wants to be participating, which companies, which independents, how many spaces do we have available. And this, as we planned for this year, we also have had a huge interest in the new original works, Renegade Now. And that's a part of the festival that we really want to give some special focus to. And so we decided it made sense to split into 2 weekends. So the first weekend is completely focused on Renegade Now, new original works. And then the second weekend will be all of these different theater companies and independents. And that has made some additional space available so we could do everything in 2 weekends.
Melissa Kaplan is an organizer of the Renegade Theater Festival back this year for 2 weekends in Old Town. This is a Thursday through Saturday affair, the 11th through the 13th, and then the following Thursday through Saturday, the 18th through the 21st. Do you know enough about the presentations, the plays, everything that you can give us a little? Is there anything in particular? I love the sound of the bad actors and bad auditions. I mean, that's just anybody who enjoys comedy has got to see that's full of potential. What else do you know about that you're excited about?
Well, without being too biased, being working at LCC, I know the play that we are presenting is called This Is a Play. And one of the things that's interesting to me about that is the playwright, Daniel McKeever, is the same playwright who wrote Never Swim Alone, which for LCC was just a huge accomplishment this past year. It was a play that we were invited to present in Milwaukee at the Kennedy Center American College Theater
Festival.
Your
last visit was, we had that discussion.
I was remembering
last time
that
you were here. Yeah.
Yes, and Monica Tanner, who was in that play, is directing This Is a Play. And it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's an interesting presentation of what it is about, what it means to be an actor. And it's a play within a play within a play. It's a short piece. Peppermint Creek is doing a version of Lord of the Flies. There'll be an excerpt at Renegade, and then that is actually the play that opens their fall season. Mm-hmm. And it is being done all with women. So that's a bit of a twist. Out of the 20-some plays being presented August 18th through 20th, 8 of them are new. They are plays that are in works. And this is one of the great things about Renegade is that it gives theater companies and independents a place to experiment and to try something out that they may not know if they want to put on their season. Or for independents who don't have a performance space, this is where they get to present their work. Sandra Seaton has created a new musical, and it's going to be a musical reading. She's working with faculty at the School of Music at MSU, and it's called Ogden Avenue, and it's set in the 1950s, and it's about teens and the racial tensions at that time. That's pretty exciting. Jane Fallon has written a play called The Gales of November, and it's about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. She is backed by Riverwalk Theater, so they're presenting that. Rich Helder last year created a play and presented a scene of something called Internal Enemy, and that is about the Armenian genocide. This year he's back with the play fully fleshed out. Those are a handful of highlights of new works. MSU's Theater to Film program is doing a play at Renegade. We have a number of comedy and improv groups who will be presenting. The Capital City Comedy or Capital City Improv is doing three nights at Spiral, and Skilled Trade Cabaret has one night at Urban Beat.
Lots going on here.
Yeah.
You, in amidst all of this stage activity, you've got live music planned.
Yes.
Can you tell us about some of the bands you've got lined up, and why do you make music a part of this thing too?
Well, it's a festival, and we want to create a festive atmosphere. Now, Old Town in itself is festive, even when there isn't a festival going on there, because there's, you know, there's fun galleries and shops to go into. There's bars, coffee shops, restaurants, but it's such a festival community. For us, we wanted to create a little bit of glue in between the theater productions for people to enjoy in between seeing plays. So we have music at 6 and at 8 o'clock Thursday through Friday. That's the second weekend only. The second weekend really is the full festival. The first weekend is devoted to the new original works. And that's all in the Red Cedar Friends. But the second weekend we have soapbox speeches that will be at 6:30 on the Dreammaker stage. That's an outdoor stage, so people can listen to those. They can go down to the Turner stage and hear music. We have country, we have Latin music, we have folk, we have indie rock. There's a lot of different music going on.
That alone would be quite a production here.
I know.
That's in addition to everything that is staged, dramatic, comedic, musical.
Yep, spoken word, performance art, experimental.
Impressive. Impressive. Where can people learn more?
People can find more information at renegadetheaterfestival.org. They can also go to our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram pages. We have complete schedules. We'll have a big insert coming out in the City Pulse that'll have the entire program on August 10th. And so they'll be able to see the entire schedule, which is also online as well.
RenegadeTheaterFestival.org. Melissa Kaplan is with Lansing Community College. She's the Academic Coordinator of Communication, Media, and the Arts at LCC. She is also one of the real spark plugs for the Renegade Theater Festival. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, the knife, the axe, the compass, and the matchbox. Youper Webster Marble said that's all you need to go deep into the woods. A new Lansing exhibit, Inventing the Outdoors, takes us on a classic Michigan experience. That's coming up. Last Wednesday, some of you may know, weather got in the way of our most recent pop-up stories presentation at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. We're going to still go forward with the storytelling. We're set for Wednesday the 10th at Valley Court Park. A lot of the storytellers can make it back, and we're confident we can avoid weather issues this time around. So, pop-up stories Wednesday the 10th at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. If you'd like more information, check out our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing, Wednesday the 10th for our next pop-up stories. We hope you can make it. The American Association of Retired Persons has represented the interests of older Americans for almost 60 years. Over that time, its emphasis has shifted from retirees to include workers over the age of 50. In 1999, the organization dropped that lengthy name and now simply goes by the acronym AARP. AARP has a new national president. He's an attorney from Lansing. Current State Scott Poles spoke with attorney Eric Schneidewind about the organization and its future. What's AARP working on these days, Scott?
Well, as you might imagine, Mark, AARP hopes to wield the influence of its millions of members in notable ways, including on issues like Medicare, Medicaid, long-term care, and Social Security. Eric Schneidewind, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
In the interest of disclosure, I signed up for AARP pretty quickly after I turned 50. Did you do the same?
Absolutely. I think I began to see the benefits, the discounts, the programs, and that overcame the slight trauma of turning 50, and pretty soon I became a member of AARP.
And I imagine you would encourage people turning 50 this year to do the same.
Absolutely. You know, we have programs that appeal to people of all ages, really, but I think the prospective member needs to know that, first of all, of course, there are the famous discounts that we get, but also there are a lot of programs that help people in your community. We have programs to mentor school children, to do tax returns for people who need help, to help people with driver training programs. One of my favorite is a program that really helps stop these fraud approaches and scams that are taking money away from people, perhaps your parents, your grandparents. So there's a lot of programs that allow you to help other people. There are programs that let you look at changes in your life. Maybe you want to change career. And we have programs that help you make those decisions. So it's really for people living life to the fullest possible extent, going out and doing things, but also helping others.
We have some of those programs locally here in the Lansing area?
Absolutely. There are active driver training programs, tax aid programs. Yes.
What would you say are the biggest issues facing America's seniors?
I think we have three real buckets that we divide issues into. First is the health bucket, and the traditional programs of Medicare and Medicaid, which touch 55 million people, older Americans, but also long-term care. Every one of us has either given long-term care or will receive long-term care. And AARP is really focusing on that issue to try to help those people give the care or get the care they need. Then there are issues of saving and having enough money for retirement in particular. We protect and really defend Social Security. We have a major national program called Take a Stand, which is going to try to press the national candidates, the president, senators, representatives, to really take a stand and tell us what they will do to make sure Social Security is solvent. But we also help people save money and have programs that will allow them to save more easily and, in fact, to keep working if they wish, to get a job, maybe to phase out, but get a part-time job, to make sure employers understand the value of older people. And then finally, the programs that deal with transitions in life that let you sort of plan ahead if you want to try a different career or what to do with your retirement, how to make it more fulfilling. So those are the major issues we're dealing with.
Eric Schneidewind of Lansing is the new national president of AARP. Now, you brought up the political arena. I know that AARP asked both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to explain their positions on Social Security reform. What did each of the candidates say?
Well, Secretary Clinton indicated that she wanted to expand Social Security benefits, particularly for low-income people who have low-paying jobs and have been in and out of the workforce. And really, most typically, that's a single mother, for instance, who's gone in and out to care for children or an adult. She also indicates that in order to pay for that program, she would raise the amount of income that was subject to the Social Security tax to extend it to higher income people, that she would not cut benefits of Social Security, would not raise the age level. Mr. Trump indicated that his path would be first to implement a very large-scale program of tax cuts throughout the spectrum. Then, if those tax cuts yielded a very high level of economic growth, and these are his words, he would move to secure Social Security. So that's his position.
Now, it's my understanding that AARP told the candidates that if you give us your positions on Social Security, we'll inform our members of what those positions are, and then afterwards we will not be endorsing a candidate for president. Am I understanding that correctly?
You know, you're absolutely right, Scott. First of all, a publication such as the Monthly Bulletin that's customized not only for the state, but did contain those positions, and it came out within the last 30 days for all our members. And yes, you know, we're a non-profit tax-exempt organization, and we cannot be partisan. And we did make a commitment in this case to the candidates that if they would take a stand and outline their position for us, that we would publish that, make it available to our members, but not take a position on whether we liked it or didn't like it.
Is that consistent with past presidential elections?
In the past, often we have had a number of issues that we try to get their opinion on and then provide voter information. That's been done. But this is, in my memory, the first time that we've really focused on a single issue, the future and solvency of Social Security, and really pressed that point with that kind of focus.
Now, AARP endorsed Obamacare when the plan was emerging, and as a result, some conservative groups criticized AARP for that. It maybe even encouraged some of their members to drop their membership in AARP. Can you tell me how that has played out over the last few years? Has membership been affected adversely by that kind of attack from conservative groups who disagreed with AARP on Obamacare?
I think it's safe to say that our current enrollment is the highest that it's ever been. So certainly during the recession years and the worst of it, a lot of people cut back, and we really didn't keep track of the reasons. But I can say that our membership is up substantially. We are at record high levels.
When people think about lobbying groups and membership groups in America, the first group that tends to come to mind a lot of times is the National Rifle Association. Best I can figure is their membership is in the area of 5 million. AARP claims something like 38 million members. How do you compare the clout of the AARP to a group like the NRA, which has tremendous influence? Does AARP wield the influence it could with numbers like that?
It's really hard to make a comparison because I think it's safe to say NRA has a very narrow focus, obviously. AARP has a wider focus on a number of social programs, but our trademark, our historically trademark program, has been Social Security and then perhaps Medicare and Medicaid. And I think when we weigh in on those subjects, we have a great deal of clout. So back in the 2005 time frame, when there was a move to privatize Social Security, we certainly opposed that, and I think we're very effective in making sure that did not happen.
What about politics in Lansing? How much influence does AARP have in Lansing, and on what issues at the state level?
The state, of course, does not fund or regulate Social Security and to a large degree Medicare. We have more involvement in Medicaid. So I think we've been very effective. And interestingly enough, very recently we obtained passage of the so-called CARE Act, which really provides a lot more information and direction to caregivers upon the discharge from a hospital of somebody who's been hospitalized. And we had that was a bipartisan piece of legislation. It was signed certainly by the governor. It was endorsed and supported by members of both parties in the legislature. So I think we've done rather well.
Eric Schneidewind of Lansing is our guest. He's the new president of the AARP in the United States. I had a final question for you. When you consider demographics, tell me about your vision for AARP in the future, 5, 10, 20 years from now. Your new 50-year-old members could be in AARP for 40 or 50 years, maybe even more. Tell me about your vision for the future for AARP.
I think it goes back to those three basic categories. The difference is that it's pretty clear that a lot of our members are going to be living longer than they did before. Not all of them. We have to recognize that. But that many of them will consider working longer. So I would think AARP by then will have made a lot of progress in eliminating or reducing discrimination against older workers, demonstrating to employers that older workers can be just as productive and bring different skills, but valuable skills, to the workplace. I think we will have on-the-job savings programs for almost everybody that let them easily save and augment their retirement. I think we will have probably restructured Social Security so that it's more responsive to that lower income worker who is in and out of the workforce. I think Medicare and Medicaid, just like the entire healthcare spectrum, is going to be restructured, or at least the delivery of the benefits, in ways that will probably promote healthy living, which frankly, you know, the best kept secret in healthcare is that if you took good care of yourself, if you exercise, if you don't smoke, if you keep your weight in check, those activities really are about 60% or more to the secret of living a healthy life and a longer life that you enjoy. So we hope that those habits will be ingrained in people and that we will help make that happen. And I think the Medicaid programs that many people depend on are certainly evolving rapidly now, so that hopefully there can be cost savings on the one hand and better care for people with chronic illnesses. So those are the kinds of things I hope to see achieved in the coming years.
We've been talking with the new president of AARP, Eric Schneidewind of Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
The Michigan Historical Museum in Lansing is presenting the exhibit Inventing the Outdoors. It details the story of Native son Webster Marble. Marble was a woodsman, inventor, and a businessman who manufactured a wide range of tools for use in outdoor settings. Inventing the Outdoors shows how Marble's ideas led to a shift in the public's view of the forest, from an exploitable set of resources to a landscape that could be enjoyed as recreation. WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Museum Executive Director Sandra Clark about how Webster Marble played in the same league as contemporaries Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward.
He's an incredible advertiser. He advertised in all the national magazines, and he had a whole group of people who were retailers, so he did a monthly publication for them with stories about the outdoors and using the products and things. One of the things that just charms me, because once I worked in publications, and you know, when you're buying advertising, you need to know if it works. So he's up in Gladstone, Michigan. He's got the only big factory in town, so every one of his advertisements has a different street address for the mailback cards, so he would know what things people were responding for. He'd also advertise on the back page and the centerfold of the magazine, because those are the two things people look at first.
He also used celebrity endorsement. You looked at some of the things that he made, axes, knives, carried by some pretty big names.
Yes, his compass, and carried by Lindbergh when he crossed the Atlantic, North Pole with Perry. And it wasn't just that he was getting these guys to carry it for advertising. He was producing the best and the finest of outdoor equipment. He was very selective in what he produced. Started with the safety axe, which to me is another great story. This is the idea of find a need and then solve a problem. When he was working in the woods and when he was camping, he loved hunting, fishing, everything in the outdoors. Take your little axe with its little sheath. Well, the axe can cut through the sheath and cut your pants, or you can lose the sheath and have a very dangerous implement. So he invents an axe that has a metal sheath and it folds into the handle. You never lose it, it never cuts through it. And that's the first big successful product. Gun sights. They stick up, they get broken, they get twisted, they don't work.
They hang up on your clothes.
Right. So he invents one that collapses. And in fact, the Marble Arms Company that still exists in Gladstone, that's the one product they still produce.
Speaking of gun sights, a pretty nifty firearm was also a Marble product.
Yes. Probably my favorite of all of these artifacts is the Game Getter. And this is Marble at his very best. You know, you don't want to carry too much with you. So the Game Getter has two different gauges, so you can use it. And it's got a collapsible stock, so you can use it as a shotgun or as a pistol. And one of my very favorite advertisements that he has the guy that's actually cleaning game, and there's a big cat on his shoulder, and he's raising the game getter pistol to take care of the cat while he's busy cleaning his other game.
Right, he says things like, you know, you're out for squirrels and there's a deer. What's the guy to do?
Right, you just pull up the stock and use the other barrel.
Yeah, you saw imitators after this with these sort of two-barrel firearms. You have a shotgun and maybe like a .22 rifle underneath. He was the first to do that.
He was the first to do that. He invented something that those of us who camped back in the old days, and probably still campers today, the match safe. If you're out in the woods and your matches get wet, you're in trouble, especially if you're really out in the woods and it's cold. And so, but it's a 10 and a 12 gauge shotgun shell slipping into each other are the beginnings of that little match safe that we all ended up carrying when we were Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. That he evolves. You know, he said all you needed to survive in the woods was a safety axe, a match safe, a compass, and a good knife. And that's what he focused on.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Sandra Clark, Executive Director of the Michigan Historical Museum here in downtown Lansing. We're talking about Webster Marble, the inventor, the businessman, and the subject of the exhibit here entitled Inventing the Outdoors. I'm just a huge fan of the knives, and you have a great display over here about the incredible variety of skinning knives, sort of general purpose knives, camping knives, and they're absolutely without peer.
Yes, I am told, I'm not an expert on knives, but I'm told by those that know, they are beautifully crafted. And you could get any kind of handle you wanted. You could get leather, you could get bone. They were made not just to be wonderfully utilitarian, but also to be things of beauty.
We're looking at a gear that a woman might wear into the woods, kind of a tunic and a skirt. But then there's something really cool there that's pinned to the shirt. You mentioned the compass earlier.
Right, and he obviously didn't invent the compass, but having had the experience of falling in water and losing his compass when he was out and getting lost and getting a little bit frightened, good woodsman that he was, his invention was the compass that attached to your clothes so you would never lose your compass. And it's a tiny thing, but
so
you always
simple.
Got it. So simple, but so valuable. And again, you see a need, you see a problem, and you solve it, and then you market the dickens out of it.
Yeah, these are great ideas. He didn't invent, like you say, the compass or the match or the knife or the hatchet or the axe, but he made them that much better.
Exactly, and made a very successful company in doing so, and did it all in Gladstone, Michigan. We talk about a world economy today. This guy in 1900 understood that the nation and the world were his market.
Yeah, take us to that place, Gladstone. I mean, what a likely and unlikely setting at the same time.
Exactly. He picked it because he liked being out and he liked the North Woods. He liked the Upper Peninsula, so he chose to live there. A place, obviously, where his business became the dominant business in town. But all he needed was mail connections to serve anybody in the nation.
Right, it's a huge factory, too, as
yes.
is pictured over here in the corner of the exhibit. An enormous factory for such a remote place.
Exactly, and yet I'm told that the shed out behind his house was where he would sit and dream up these things. The other thing we have here is some copies of the books that he carried with him when he was doing the lumbering work. And he was recording very specifically what he saw, where it was, all this detail. But in the back, you see sketches of things like an axe that would work better. So that invention was always in him.
Outdoorsman, inventor, entrepreneur, Webster Marble is featured in the exhibit Inventing the Outdoors. Sandra Clark, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, Flint has struggled with a poor economy and tainted drinking water for a long time now. A new book might help lift the spirits of the people of Flint and put the city in a more positive light for outsiders. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Scott Atkinson, the editor of Happy Anyway, a Flint anthology. Plus, the Dance Lansing project is currently underway. We'll speak with the artistic director as well as a guest choreographer who's used her experiences as a Michigan migrant worker to craft a dance coming to MSU's Paysant Theater. That and more Tuesday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Everything we do ends up there and at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.